Chapter 6, How to Use 3 Big Secrets for Attracting People. What is the secret of an attractive personality? We've all known them, those people who just seem to attract customers and friends. We say that people are drawn to such a personality, or he just draws people to him. Such phrases are very descriptive, for you can't force people to like you, but you can draw them to you if you supply food to feed 3 basic human hungers. Put out a T-bone steak on your back doorstep, and you don't have to ride herd on the dogs in your neighborhood to get them to come. They'll be there. And when the word gets around that you have in stock the 3 basic foods that I want to tell you about in this chapter, people will be attracted to you in the same way. The genuinely nice guy whom everybody avoids. Friendship doesn't just happen. We choose our friends. And either consciously or unconsciously, we choose them on the basis of need and hunger. Sam Sweet Talk may be the nicest, sweetest, most considerate man that you've ever met in your whole life. Yet you may not choose Sam for a personal friend for the simple reason that Sam doesn't offer any food to feed your hungers. In fact, you may find yourself uncomfortable in Sam's presence. All the goodness that is oozing out of him all the time may only make you feel guilty and inferior. So, although Sam is a nice guy, you avoid him like the plague. The AAA formula for attracting people. There are 3 basic hungers that all normal human beings have. You might call this the AAA technique for winning friends. For when you use these 3 A's with an understanding of what is behind them, you'll find more and more people automatically warming up to you. Number 1, acceptance. Acceptance is a vitamin. We all hunger to be accepted as we are. We want someone we can relax with, someone we can let our hair down and take our shoes off with. Very few of us are brave enough to be ourselves completely when dealing with the world in general, but we like to have somebody that we can be ourselves with. Someone we can afford to be ourselves with, because we know we'll be accepted. The critical, fault-finding type of person who always sees where others fall short and can usually also suggest a remedy is never going to be stampeded by crowds rushing to be his close friends. Don't set up rigid personal standards of how you think other people ought to act. Give the other person the right to be himself. If he's a little peculiar, let him be. Don't insist that he do everything that you do and like everything you like. Let him relax when he's around you. Strangely enough, the people who accept people and like them just as they are have the most influence in changing the other person's behavior for the better. Many a married man who's changed from a wild and woolly character into a solid citizen will tell you, if you can get him to talk about it, that the one thing which enabled him to change was, quote, the faith my wife had in me, unquote. Or that, quote, my wife just believed in me. She never criticized or nagged, but just kept on believing in me. Somehow, I just had to change, unquote. As one psychologist expressed it, quote, no one has the power to reform another person, but by liking the other person as he is, you give him the power to change himself, unquote. Many good people have little or no influence on others who might be influenced by them for the better simply because they cannot accord the other person any acceptance as he is, but give the other person the idea that he must change some way in order to earn their acceptance. There is no record that any Pharisee ever changed the conduct of any sinner. The Pharisees were good people, but their very goodness separated them from other men. They were horrified when Jesus ate with publicans and sinners. They were aghast when he told the woman taken in adultery, quote, neither do I condemn thee, unquote. But the fact remains that Jesus had a way with people that no one had equaled before or has since. How psychoanalysts help people do better. Have you ever considered what really happens when a person is psychoanalyzed? I'm not talking about the movie version, but in real life, where a person with all sorts of fears and problems, a person who can't get along with himself and can't get along with others, gets cured merely by going twice a week to a doctor's office and talking with a doctor. Recently, I met a prominent psychoanalyst at a dinner party, and talk got around to the matter of acceptance in human relations. If people really practiced acceptance, we'd soon be out of business, he told me. For the very heart of psychoanalysis is that the patient finds one person, the doctor, who will accept him. For the first time in his life, he lets his hair down. He brings out his fears, the things he's ashamed of, and the doctor listens without surprise or horror or moral judgment. Because he's found one human being who shows acceptance in spite of all his shameful traits and faults, he's able to accept himself, and then he's on the road to better living. How to make your marriage vows come true. Dr. Ruth Barbee says that much marital unhappiness could be avoided if young couples would take to heart the words of the marriage ceremony. Quote, I take this man or woman for better or for worse, unquote. You must accept the other person as he or she is, she says. Quoting the doctor, emotional acceptance does not mean lowering your ideals. It's the way you feel about a person, not the way you think about him. It's an affirmation of him as a person. It's a recognition that basically and fundamentally, he is something that you can accept. It has to do with the stuff he's made of rather than what he does or doesn't do. Everyone needs this feeling of acceptance. No man is accepted by everybody, and it's foolish to attempt to be. But each of us must be accepted by the people who count to us. The punishment that the man without a country suffered was the punishment of being accepted by no one at all. Even the most ruthless of men who have set themselves against the entire world feel the need for this acceptance. Hitler, for instance, surrounded himself with a small group of admirers and took them with him everywhere he went. Acceptance is a two-edged sword. One of the tragedies of our society is that this need for acceptance works against society as well as for it. The many teenage gangs that are springing up around the country, for example, are no doubt due in large part to the fact these boys, who are not accepted in other places in society, attain some personal significance, some sense of belonging, through the acceptance of the members of the gang. Another tragedy is that very often when a man gets out of prison, he may have learned his lesson and have only the best of intentions, but he soon finds that an ex-jailbird is not accepted among nice people. About the only place where he can get a feeling of acceptance is among criminals and other ex-criminals. How to make your husband or wife successful. Many big businessmen tell me that before they promote a man, they like to find out something about his wife. They're interested not so much in whether she's good-looking or charming or a good cook and so forth, but primarily in whether she gives her husband a feeling of confidence. The president of one corporation expressed it this way, quote, when a wife accepts her husband and gives him a feeling that she's pleased with him, as is, it's like getting a shot of self-confidence in the arm every time the husband goes home. He says to himself, quote, if she likes me, maybe I'm not such a bad guy after all, unquote. If she seems to like him and believe in him, he says, maybe I can do it after all. And he goes out to meet the world the next morning, brimming over with self-confidence and with a feeling that whatever comes along, he can lick it. But when a man goes home to a nagging, complaining, scolding wife, it's like having all the fight taken out of him. Her continual dissatisfaction with him comes across to him and adds to his germ of self-doubt, and he begins to doubt himself, unquote. He might have added that a wife who gives her husband acceptance not only gives him a dose of self-confidence, but also gives him a good dose of human kindness, and that easy to get along with quality. For by her acceptance, she helps him like himself better. When he likes himself better, he's going to be easier to get along with. He's going to be more thoughtful and considerate. To the wife who's continually nagging, on the other hand, gets just the opposite of what she wants. She helps her husband like himself less, and the lower his self-esteem sinks, the more irritable and fault-finding he's going to be with her. Perhaps it's poetic justice after all. Of course, everything I've said about wives applies just as much, if not more so, to husbands. Men can be greater naggers than women. And the sarcastic, fault-finding, ego-deflating husband also gets what he asks for. Number 2. Approval. The second magic A that everyone hungers for is approval. Approval goes a little further than acceptance. Acceptance is mostly negative in comparison. We accept the other person with his faults and shortcomings and still accord him our friendship. But approval means something more positive. It goes beyond just tolerating another's faults and find something positive that we can like. You can always find something to approve of in the other person. You can always find something of which you disapprove. It depends upon what you're looking for. If you're a negative type personality, you're always looking for flaws, always on the lookout for things you can disapprove of. If you're a positive type of personality, you're always looking out for things that you can approve of. Negative personalities literally bring out the worst in us, for they highlight all the things that are wrong with us. Positive personalities bring out the good in us by highlighting something they can approve of. We bask in the sunlight of their approval, and the feeling is so good that we start trying to develop other traits and characteristics to draw approval that give us that good feeling all over again. A cure for incorrigible children. A child psychologist told me not long ago about a boy who was brought to him labeled incorrigible. The child was supposed to be uncontrollable. He was moody and at first wouldn't even talk to the psychologist. There simply seemed to be no handle with which to take hold of him. The psychologist got his clue from a remark made by the boy's father, who said, quote, "This is the only child I've ever seen who doesn't have a single likable trait, not a single one," unquote. The psychologist started looking for some one thing he could approve. He found several. The boy liked to carve. He did it well. At home, he carved up the furniture. He'd been punished for it. The psychologist bought him a carving set and a set of carving knives and some soft wood. He also gave him some suggestions on how to use them and didn't hold back his approval. "You know, Jimmy," he said, "you can carve out things better than any boy I ever knew." Well, to make a long story short, he soon found other things to approve, and one day Jimmy surprised everyone by cleaning up his own room without being asked. When the psychologist asked him why he did it, he said, well, quote, "I thought you'd like that," unquote. Go out of the way to approve. We are all hungry for approval, and it doesn't have to be a big thing in order to satisfy our hunger. Praise a stockbroker about his ability to buy and sell stocks, and has little effect on him. He's apt to think you're merely flattering him because of his success as a stockbroker. It's too obvious. But if you will let him know that you approve of the way that he broils a steak over charcoal, he'll call your name blessed. A good rule to remember in complimenting people is this. People are more pleased at a compliment if you praise them for some virtue that is not glaringly obvious. If a man has the physique of a Greek god, chances are he already knows it. There's little doubt in his mind about it. He doesn't need any confirmation. But he may be good at other things which are not so obvious. Seek out these and praise him for them. Watch him glow. Number 3. Appreciation is magic. Another basic hunger is the hunger for appreciation. The word appreciate really means to raise in value, or the opposite of depreciate, which means lower in value. We are always looking for people who will raise us in value rather than lower us in value. Dr. Pierce P. Brooks told me recently that the success of his insurance companies is due in large part to the motto, quote, "We appreciate our agents," unquote. When I asked how such a simple motto could work such a miracle, a leading insurance magazine recently described the growth of his companies as miraculous, he pointed out the fact that appreciate is just the opposite of depreciate. "We value our agents highly," he said. "We let them know we value them highly. We know that the success of any company depends upon the success of its agents. They're important to us. We think that they are the best in the business, and all our dealings with them are on that basis." When you appreciate a person, you actually make him more valuable and more successful. Unquote. Other people are valuable to you. Stop and consider just how valuable other people are to you. Your wife, husband, children, your boss, your employees, your customers. Emphasize their value in your own mind. Then figure out little ways to let the other person know you value him highly. And always remember that people are the most important, the most valuable things on earth. Here are a few ways to show appreciation. Give a little thought, and you can think of many more. 1. Don't keep people waiting if you can help it. 2. If you have a caller whom you can't see immediately, acknowledge his presence and let him know that you'll see him as soon as possible. 3. Thank people. 4. Treat people as special. 4 is worth a little additional comment. One of the most deflating, depreciating things in the world is to be given the routine treatment. We all want to be treated special, as an individual, recognized for our own unique worth. If Mary finds out that John tells that to all the girls, she feels that John has depreciated her. She would much prefer that his theme song be "For You Alone." Dr. Pierce P. Brooks tells me that he once sent out form letters to prospects in connection with a new subdivision he was opening up. The letter began, quote, "Dear friend," unquote, and the response was almost zero. By changing these two words and typing in the addressee's own name, for example, "Dear Mr. Smith," the return on the mailing was very successful. Don't talk station to station, but person to person. People don't like to be classified and pigeonholed into broad general categories such as customers, people, children, married couples. They want to be acknowledged as one particular and unique customer or person. The skeptic who says all customers are just alike is headed down the road to bankruptcy, whether he knows it or not. The woman who says all men are just alike is apt to live the rest of her days in spinsterhood. It's easy to fall into the habit of treating people as customers, but it doesn't pay. Remember, whatever you're doing, you never deal with customers in the abstract. You're always dealing with one individual person. You'll never learn to get along with people. You learn to get along with this person and that person. There's no such animal as people. The world is populated with individual persons. People is just an abstract term. We like to be singled out, not considered one of the mob. We like to go to those restaurants where we're given individual treatment. It doesn't have to be much. Perhaps the head waiter only calls you by name and says, "Mrs. Jones, you'll be happy to know we have shish kebab tonight." "We don't usually do this, but in your case, I'm going to make an exception," someone says to us. We glow all over. "Mrs. Smith, I'm personally going to take care of this matter and see to it you get what you want." "Just anybody couldn't wear this dress, but you can get away with it." Even children respond to this magic. They don't like to be treated as children, but as Jimmy Jones' individual. Don't compare him with a kid down the street. This only depreciates him. Many a man, when introducing his family, will single out his wife as an individual person. This is Mrs. Jones, and dismiss with a wave of the hand his three children, and these are the children. Why depersonalize them? Why not introduce them the same as you would any other individual person? By the same token, when you're introduced to a teenager, acknowledge the introduction the same as if you were being introduced to the president of a bank. Instead of just waving your hand and saying, "Hi," why not shake hands and say, "Hello, Dick. I'm very happy to meet you." Take a lesson from Mother Nature. Take a lesson from the flowers. They know how to attract bees. They want the bee to pollinate them. They need the bee. But instead of pleading or scolding or coercing, the flower just puts out a few drops of nectar. The flower knows that the bee is hungry for nectar. It provides food to feed the hunger. If you will analyze the person with the attractive personality, you'll find that he too offers food to feed basic hungers of human beings. There's an old saying, in effect, that honey attracts more flies than vinegar. It is often interpreted to mean that you should sweet-talk your way to what you want. A closer look, however, will show that honey attracts flies simply because honey is food that the fly wants and needs. Put out a bowl of honey, and you don't have to go up and down the street with a sound truck telling the flies about it. You don't have to organize committees to convince the flies they should come. They'll be there. And when you begin to put out these three basic foods, you can count on people to flock to you in droves. A quick rundown on Chapter 6. 1. The real secret of an attractive personality is to offer other people the food they are hungry for. People are as hungry for certain things as flies are for honey. Number two, use the AAA formula for attracting people. Acceptance. Accept people as they are. Allow them to be themselves. Don't insist on anyone being perfect before you can like him. Don't fashion a moral straitjacket and expect others to wear it in order to gain your acceptance. Above all, don't bargain for acceptance. Don't say in substance, I'll accept you if you do this or that or change your ways to suit me. Approval. Look for something to approve in the other person. It may be something small or insignificant, but let the other person know that you approve of that, and the number of things you can sincerely approve of will begin to grow. When the other person gets a taste of your genuine approval, he will begin to change his behavior so that he'll be approved for other things. Appreciation. To appreciate means to raise in value, as opposed to depreciate, which means to lower in value. Let other people know that you value them. Treat the other person as though they were valuable to you. Don't keep them waiting. Thank them. Give them special, individual treatment. Chapter 7. How to make the other fellow feel friendly instantly. Have you ever known one of those fellows who never met a stranger? He seems to make friends instantly. He sits down next to someone on a bus, and right away they're talking away as if they were old friends. He calls upon a prospect, and the prospect starts right off dealing with him as if they'd been old friends all their lives. On the other hand, we've all known people who are nice, once you get to know them, but are hard to get to know. The first class seem to have some magic, almost as if they can turn on a friendly feeling in the other fellow, while the second, hard-to-get-to-know type, are handicapped in getting along in the world. While they are warming up to the other fellow, some easy-to-know fellow has already taken the business and gone. How to use the magic switch that turns on friendly feelings? I learned about these easy-to-know types when I was in college. I was a little on the shy side as far as girls were concerned. If I saw a good-looking girl, I would want to ask her for a date, but instead would tell myself, quote, she probably wouldn't like it if I just went up and asked her for a date. She'd probably think I was being too fresh. She probably has a date anyway, probably going steady with the best-looking boy in school, or wouldn't even consider going out with me, unquote. So I'd sit back and think about ways I could get introduced to her and what I was going to say to her. Sometimes I'd get up enough nerve to start a conversation with a girl I didn't know, and I'd walk up to her and mumble out my little prepared speech, and 9 times out of 10, the girl would react just as I'd pictured in my imagination that she would react. She'd either put on a show of indignation and say, quote, I don't know you, unquote, or she would appear to be amused by my awkward manner. Now, with my roommate, all this was different. He was one of those easy-to-know types. He'd walk up to a girl he'd never seen before in his life and start a conversation, and in 2 minutes they'd be laughing and talking like old friends. No one ever called him fresh. They actually seemed to like his bold approach. How I learned my roommate's secret. Finally, one day, I got him to tell me his secret. You've got to believe the other fellow is going to like you, he said. Well, with that clue, I got to watching my roommate more closely. He was as popular with the boys on campus as he was with the girls. Everyone seemed to like him. He even worked his magic on the professors. He could get by with things in class that I would have been thrown out for. Yet the professors would just laugh and seem to think he was a fine fellow. And as I watched him operate, I noticed that he always acted just as if the other fellow's friendly response was a foregone conclusion. Because he believed other people would like him, he acted as if they would like him, in short. He assumed the attitude he expected the other person to take. Another thing I noticed was this. Because he was thoroughly convinced that the other person would be friendly, he was not afraid of people. He was not on the defensive. Fear of people drives them away. Fear is one of the greatest handicaps to getting to know people quickly and getting off on a friendly footing. You are afraid that the other fellow will not like you, so you hole up in your shell like a snail that thinks it's about to be attacked. People can't get close to you because you're so far back in your defensive shell, and because your own attitudes are catching and have an influence on the other fellow, he begins to withdraw also. Nothing is truer in the field of human relations than this. If your basic attitude is that other people will be unfriendly, or that people just don't like me, your experience will prove it to be so. But if you have the basic attitude that most people are friendly and want to be friendly toward me, again your experience will prove it so. Take a chance he's friendly. The odds are in your favor. Get over your fear that the other person will snub you. Take the risk. Bet on his being friendly. You won't win every time, but the odds are heavily in your favor. Remember that most people do crave friendship just as you do. It's a universal craving. The reason the other fellow does not always appear friendly may be that he is afraid of you, afraid that you'll reject him. Take the initiative. Don't wait for some token of friendship from the other fellow. Make the first move, and chances are you'll see him begin to warm up. Don't be an eager beaver. We all know people who are eager beavers to win the other fellow's approval. They are the folks who try too hard to be charming, who knock themselves out to arouse friendly feelings in the other person. Most of us also know that the eager beaver is seldom, if ever, popular. All of us know girls who try so hard to get married that they scare all the men away. Many of these girls have looks, charm, beauty, all the desirable traits, and would have no trouble at all doing the very thing they want so much to do if they just didn't try so hard. Many times, the fellow who wants a certain job so badly that it shows doesn't get it. Not long ago, I was having lunch with two friends, and they brought up the name of some fellow they both knew named Bill. "Did Bill ever get that promotion?" said one. "No. The last report I had, he still hadn't gotten it," said the other. "What in the world is wrong? He certainly is in line for it. He has the ability and everything else to get it." "I don't know what the trouble is," was the answer, "unless he's just too anxious for it." Relax and take it for granted that you'll be liked. In any human relation situation, it does not pay to be overly anxious to let the other person know you are practically drooling to get what you want. The other person has a strong tendency to balk at any action he feels you are red-hot for his doing. His instinct will be to drive a harder bargain, or he may become suspicious that things are not as they seem. When you give the impression that you want the action very much, when you show anxiety, you also start him wondering why you are trying so hard, and doubts creep in. When a person comes begging for friendship, the tendency is to back away from him. This is due not to some perverse trait of human nature, but the same law of psychology we've been talking about. The eager beaver is afraid, deathly afraid, the other person will not like him or will not do what he wants. Instead of saying to himself, "I know the other fellow is going to like me," he says to himself, "I'm terribly afraid he won't like me." This gets across to the other person. The eager beaver isn't showing any faith in himself. The trick is not to knock yourself out trying to make the other fellow come through. Just relax and know that he will be friendly and reasonable. Then you'll be relaxed and calm and collected in dealing with the other fellow. One thing the eager beaver can do is smile. It's almost impossible to be worried and anxious while you're smiling. A smile is relaxing. A smile shows confidence. A smile shows that you just know the other fellow is going to come through as expected. Work miracles with a smile. Another thing I noticed about my college roommate, he was always smiling. He was the smilingest fellow I ever met. If you think about the easy-to-know people that you know, you'll find that without exception they are great smilers. They are cheerful and laugh a lot. A real sincere smile works almost like a magic switch that turns on a friendly feeling in the other fellow instantly. What a smile says. A good, sincere smile says several things to the other fellow. It says not only, "I like you, I come as a friend," but it also says, "I assume that you are going to like me." When a little puppy dog comes up to you wagging its tail, it's saying, "I'm confident you're a good guy and that you like me." Another important thing a smile says is, "You are worth smiling at." In her book, Understanding Fear in Ourselves and Others, Bonera Overstreet says, quote, "The person at whom we smile smiles back. In one sense, he smiles at us. In a deeper sense, his smile reports the sudden well-being that we've enabled him to experience. He smiles because our smile has made him feel smile-deserving. We have, so to speak, picked him out of the crowd. We've differentiated him and given him individual status, unquote. Smile from way down deep. Voice teachers are always telling their pupils to breathe deep. Let their voices come from way down deep. If you want your smile to be a friend-maker, it too must come from way down deep. In this case, not from the diaphragm, but from the heart. A smile that goes no further than the lips is no good. Remember, it's not gimmicks which influence the other person, but your true feelings about them. The best advice I ever ran across on how to smile is given by Joseph A. Kennedy in his booklet, Relax and Sell. Learn to smile on the inside, he says. It is your feeling that gets across to the customer subconscious, not your facial expression. Consciously, trying to smile by mechanically manipulating the muscles of your mouth does more harm than good. Instead, forget about your mouth and smile mentally. Imagine that you feel smiley inside. When you do this, you're relaxed, or it's impossible to feel friendly and to be tense or to feel hostile and to be relaxed. Let go and smile. One simple reason many of us do not smile more often or more sincerely is the habit we have of always holding in our true feelings. We've been taught it isn't quite nice to show the world our feelings, and we try not to wear our hearts on our sleeves or show our feelings on our faces. Maybe you think you haven't got a good smile and could never learn to smile attractively. However, my experience has been that everyone is blessed with a good smile. This is something everyone has in him. It's just a question of letting it out. It's a matter of getting over the fear of showing your true feelings, letting go, and the smile will come out by itself. For when you feel friendly and feel good about the world, you have to hold in a smile. All that's required is a little practice in expressing your feelings. You'll find the more you practice, the less inhibited you are. I have seen folks who were regular old sourpusses and poker faces develop an attractive smile just by daily practice in letting go. When you feel friendly, just let yourself go. Don't be ashamed or self-conscious about letting your face say, "Boy, am I glad to see you." How to use mirror magic. Try practicing every morning before your bathroom mirror. Remember something pleasant, something you really liked and got a kick out of. Then just let go and let this feeling break out all over your face. Think of all the wonderful things that could happen to you today. See yourself selling everyone you call on, dealing successfully with every person you meet. Conjure up good feelings, then let them out. Think that's a silly thing to do? You don't believe that such a simple thing can make any difference in the way people react to you? Frank Betker, writing in Your Life magazine, tells us how he used a daily morning smile practice session virtually to remake his personality within a very short time. Soon he found people warming up to him quicker, receiving him on more friendly terms. His sales skyrocketed. How to develop a genuine smile. If you have trouble conjuring up a smiley feeling at first, don't worry about it. Go ahead and go through the motions anyway. Say the word cheese to yourself in the mirror. Get your smile muscles warmed up. You'll begin to feel more optimistic. Our actions determine our feelings just as much as our feelings determine our actions. William James once said that it's impossible to feel pessimistic when you have the corners of your mouth turned up, and impossible to feel optimistic when you have the corners of your mouth turned down. Charles Darwin, the discoverer of evolution, wrote a little-known scientific book, Expression of Emotions in Man and Animals, in which he traced all the scientific reasons why we have certain bodily expressions to go with certain emotions. He, too, came to the conclusion that emotion and expression are so tied together in our habit system that you simply cannot really feel an emotion completely unless you express it. The very act of smiling helps you feel more friendly. Mirror practice in smiling helps you develop a good, genuine smile because it forces you to use the right smile muscles and go through the actions of a real smile instead of a phony one. People who give you a phony, superficial smile really aren't smiling at all. They aren't even using the right smile muscles, and if they could see themselves in a mirror, they'd realize that they're not smiling at all. This is the reason that the people with a phony smile do not get a genuine feeling of friendliness by going through the motions of smiling. They are going through the motions of a phony smile, and the only feeling they get is a feeling of being a phony. Everyone can recognize a real smile when he sees one. Practice before your mirror until you see a real smile. Many people have never learned what a real smile feels like. You can test the power of a smile. Recently, I gave a talk to the personnel of an outstanding chain of dairy stores throughout Ohio and neighboring states. My talk included some hints on smiling and what magic it could accomplish when rightly used. Some weeks later, I had occasion to meet one of the secretaries of this concern. She was quite enthused and anxious to tell me about some of her wonderful discoveries. After hearing my talk, she decided to test my theory on smiling. She selected as her test the shopping tour she was going to make the next day during her lunch hour. The next day turned out to be a very humid day, raining hard and generally disagreeable and depressing. The stores were nonetheless crowded, and she despaired of being able to buy the 5 items she needed because they were each in different departments in 3 different stores. She remembered my suggestion to give the other fellow a big smile before saying a word. She was able to complete all 5 transactions in less than 30 minutes. Never before had she accomplished so much shopping in so short a time. She was really thrilled because she had received the best service and gotten the finest treatment at all the stores. One counter was surrounded by a large group of women anxious to be waited on. Most of them were scowling and impatient. The young lady caught the eye of the sales clerk and gave her a big smile and got waited on first. Use your million-dollar asset. If you're not using your smile, you're like a man with $1 million in the bank and no checkbook. A smile is the million-dollar asset in your human relations inventory. From long experience in dealing with people and in teaching people how to develop their smiles in my human relations and sales clinics, I've come to the conclusion that everyone has a $1 million smile locked up inside him. What else has the magic of a smile? What else can perform the magic of a smile? Pay someone a compliment and smile, and it multiplies the compliment many times. Ask someone for a favor and smile. He almost feels compelled to grant it. Accept a favor from someone else and smile, and you add to the appreciation the other fellow feels. Even when you have to use somewhat plain talk, a smile takes the sting out. Smile when you say that, we say to a friend, and if he smiles, almost anything he says is all right. Meet someone for the first time and smile, and he feels like he's known you all his life. You couldn't buy a magic elixir like that if you had all the money in the world. Yet the good Lord gave you just such magic. All you have to do is bring it out of hiding, dust it off, and put it to use. Chapter 7 in summary. Number 1. Human relations often become deadlocked because each party is afraid to make the first move. Number 2. Don't wait for a sign from the other fellow. Assume that he is going to be friendly and act accordingly. Number 3. Assume the attitude that you wish the other person to take. Act as if you expected him to like you. Number 4. Take a chance that the other fellow will be friendly. It's always a gamble, but you'll win 99 times for every time you lose if you'll just bet on his being friendly. Refuse to take the chance, you'll lose every time. Number 5. Don't be an eager beaver. Don't be overly anxious. Don't knock yourself out trying to make the other fellow like you. Remember, there is such a thing as being too charming and trying too hard. Number 6. Just relax and take for granted that other people do like you. Number 7. Use the magic of your smile to warm up the other fellow. Number 8. Starting today, begin to develop a genuine smile by practicing before your bathroom mirror. You know what a real smile looks like when you see one. Your mirror will tell you whether your smile is real or phony. Also, going through the motions of smiling will get you in the habit and actually make you feel more like smiling. Chapter 8. How you can develop skill in using words. If talking to others is one of your weak points in human relations, I strongly urge you to read Harry Simmons' interesting and helpful book, How to Talk Your Way to Success. After more than 25 years in business management and human relations work, Mr. Simmons says that he's found that success often depends upon your ability or inability to talk as upon your ability to do your job. When I first heard the title of Simmons' book, it seemed to me somewhat of an exaggeration. But then I got to thinking about the successful men and women I know. As I went on down the list, it turned out that every single one was a good talker. The one thing successful people have in common. Wilfred Funk, editorial director of Your Life magazine, made a study of thousands of successful men and women looking for some one common denominator. He found that the one thing that all these people had in common was skill in using words. He found earning power and word skills so closely tied together that you can safely expect to increase your earnings simply by increasing your word power. Happiness depends on talk. Our happiness, too, depends to a great extent upon our ability to express our ideas, desires, hopes, ambitions, or disappointments to other people by use of talk. Explorers who return from lonely expeditions will tell you what they miss most is the small talk with other human beings. Psychiatrists have found that many people are unhappy because, for one reason or another, they are unable to express themselves and carry their ideas and emotions around bottled up inside of them. How to strike up a conversation. Many people are handicapped because they do not know how to start a conversation, especially with a stranger. They have a wealth of interesting ideas on tap, if only they knew how to turn them on. But they hold back because it would seem inane to start off abruptly with some profound observation on the nature of man or the universe, and they're afraid they'll be thought of as dull or obvious if they come out with something as trite as, well, it looks as if it might rain. William James hit the nail on the head when he said the reason why so many people find it difficult to be good conversationalists is that they are afraid of either saying something too trivial and obvious or something insincere or something unworthy of one's interlocutor, or in some way or another not adequate to the occasion. His remedy wag, quote, "Conversation does flourish, and society is refreshing, whenever people take the brakes off their hearts and let their tongues wag as automatically and irresponsibly as they will," unquote. Stop trying to be perfect. John D. Murphy, writing in Your Life magazine, in an article called Stop Trying to Be Perfect, said, quote, "No one can scintillate every minute. We do not squeeze bon mots and literary gems out of the brain by taking thought. They come out unexpectedly and spontaneously when we relax and stop being afraid to be ourselves." Ruskin once said that he wrote well only when he was not trying to write well. Henry James the Elder once wrote a friend, quote, "People often ask me, 'What do you think?' How do I know what I think until I open my mouth to speak it?" Unquote. Most of us have an entirely false mental picture of what is expected of us. Shakespeare was not afraid to be trite. Choose any classic and you'll discover long passages of outright dullness. Last week I made some notes of conversational answers given by three of the most popular MCs on television. Here are a few actual samples. Quote, "No, really? You don't say. Well, now. Well, that's something. Well, what do you know about that?" Even in the most stimulating conversations, fully 50% of what is said is not only trite, but absolutely meaningless, at least in the early stages. After a warm-up period, when the mental wheels are turning easily, the entire conversation can become original, provided the participants are not too much concerned with making it so. It's like mining for gold, somewhat. No prospector in his right mind would reject ore or feel ashamed of it that did not essay 24-karat gold. Unless you're willing to take a lot of worthless rock and earth along with a small amount of gold at the beginning, you'll never dig down where the vein is richer. Small talk isn't supposed to be brilliant. Everyone is trite, Everyone engages in small talk. That doesn't say anything clever or significant. This sort of small talk is necessary to get the wheels turning. Once you realize this and stop being afraid of being dull, you'll find that you too can start a conversation, even with a perfect stranger, and you may be surprised to find that in many cases you are saying clever and interesting things only because you aren't trying to. How to warm up to your subject. Be willing to go through a warm-up period in starting conversation. Don't expect to be hot at the very beginning. Listen to the experts on television. They know that small talk not only can start a conversation for them, but it can be used to warm up and unlimber the other person. They don't try to draw out any interesting ideas from the other person until they've warmed him up. Quote, "Well, and what is your name? Where are you from? What does your husband do? How many children do you have? How long are you going to be here? What brings you to New York?" Unquote. Who cares, you may ask. Certainly there's nothing brilliant or clever in these questions. Yet they do get the conversation rolling, and they tend to draw out the other person. How to bring out interesting talk from others. Listen to the answers these experts give. When the guest says she's from Sioux City, he says, "From Sioux City." When she says she's married and has 5 children, he says, "Five children? Well, what do you know?" These men are not dull or dumb. They go on in this vein, giving perfectly inane and trite answers and comments, while both they and the other person warm up to each other. Soon they are bringing out interesting facts, clever remarks, funny incidents. Now, if the experts, who are paid thousands of dollars a week because of their ability as conversationalists, cannot start right in with a bang, what makes you think you can? If they're not afraid to be trite and obvious, why should you be? Getting him to talk about himself. The next time you're introduced to someone and cannot think of a thing to say, take a lesson from these TV and radio experts. Try warming up the other fellow with such questions as, quote, "Where are you from, Mr. Jones? How long do you plan on being in our city? What do you think of our weather? Do you have a family? What business are you in?" Unquote. These are surefire warmer-uppers because they get the other fellow talking about himself. They break the ice and thaw out the other fellow because they show that you are interested in him. You do not have to look for a topic he can talk about. You can start him right off on the one topic he's an expert on, himself. The words "strike up a conversation" are significant. You strike up a conversation just as you strike up a bonfire. You do not expect to start right off with a raging fire. You strike only one little match to begin with. The fact that we speak of breaking the ice, thawing out the other fellow, and so on, shows that we are already subconsciously recognizing the fact that good conversations require a warm-up period. How to break the ice with strangers. You'll find that you can use this same method to start conversations with strangers on planes, buses, and trains. You'll make your trip more pleasant and may very well meet someone who'll turn into a permanent friend. Don't try to think up something profound or clever to say. Just make some observation or ask some question. Comment on what's happening around you. "Well, it looks like we're about to get underway at last. Boy, it sure is hot in here. Wish those people up front would open the windows." Another good method is to ask questions. Asking him for information not only warms the other fellow up, gives him an opening, but also makes the other fellow feel good because he's in a position to do you a small favor. "Can you tell me what time it is? What time does this plane get to Kansas City? Does the Riverside bus come by here?" Simple. Easy? Sure it is. This is the way that conversations get started. The reason most people cannot get started talking is that they try too hard to make something difficult out of it. U-turns and green lights keep conversation going. The art of being a good conversationalist consists not only so much in thinking up a lot of clever things to say or heroic experiences you can relate, but in opening up the other fellow and getting him to talk. If you can stimulate other people to talk, you'll acquire a reputation as a good conversationalist. Moreover, if you can get the other fellow talking and keep him talking, nothing will work better to get him interested in and receptive to your ideas when you're talking. A friend told me recently of trying several times unsuccessfully to get out on a fishing pier in order to get a good view of boat races that were being held in the bay. Each time a city policeman stopped him, "There are too many people out there already," the cop would say, "and I can't let anyone else on the pier until some of those people leave." "There were four of us in my party," my friend said, "including a woman who had quite a reputation as a talker. When I was turned down the third time, she said, 'Let me try.' She went out and talked with a cop for about 5 minutes, then motioned for us to come out, and he let us go by. When I asked her what in the world she said to him, she told me, 'Oh, I didn't ask him if we could go out on the pier. I just got talking to him, and I asked whether he didn't get terribly hot having to stand out there in the sun, and said he must have quite a trying job policing such a mob of people. He told me how he liked to fish and so forth, and then I just said that we were down here and especially wanted to see the races, but were very disappointed because we couldn't see anything back there on the seawall.' Then he spoke up and said, 'Why don't you go out there in the pier? You can see good from there.'" You is the magic word. This story illustrates very well one of the secrets of making conversation serve you. It can be expressed thus, quote, "Give your conversation a U-turn, and the other fellow will give you a green light," unquote. Making a U-turn may not be the thing to do in traffic, but in conversation it is a must. You is the magic word if you use it correctly. Most of us tend to turn the conversation around to I and me. When we do this, the other person is apt to give us a red light. This is what happened to my friend who tried to get past the cop on the pier. He just walked out and talked about I and me. "I would like to go out on the pier. Will you let me get out there?" The cop gave him a red light and stopped him in his tracks. It's doubtful that the cop even heard everything that he said. He probably turned on a red light in his mind and shut him out. On the other hand, when the lady went out and began to talk about the policeman, emphasizing you in the conversation, she got him warmed up and friendly, and he not only gave her a green light, but actually invited her to go out on the pier. Remember what's been said in earlier chapters in this book about human beings being interested first, last, and always in themselves. Apply this knowledge by realizing that you is a go-ahead signal in conversation, while I is a stop sign. How to ask questions to interest others. Keep the conversation steered to the other fellow's interest by asking questions: why, where, how. When he says, "I've got a little 25-acre place back home in Indiana," don't rush in and say, "Well, I own 500 acres in Texas and have 50 oil wells on it." Instead, say, "Whereabouts in Indiana? What do you have there?" If he says he has a fishing boat, don't say, "Let me tell you about my private plane." Instead, ask, "How long is it? Is it inboard or outboard? How long have you had it? Why did you do that? How did you manage that? What did you say then?" These and similar questions will get you a reputation as one of the most interesting talkers that your companion has ever met. A deadly sin in human relations and how to avoid it. Remember, human beings are innately selfish beings. They are first, last, and always interested in themselves, in their job, their family, their hometown, their ideas. Even a question like, "Where are you from?" shows that you are interested in the other person, and consequently gets him interested in you. Don't be like the young playwright who, after talking about himself and his plays for 2 hours, said to his girlfriend, quote, "Well, that's enough talking about me. Let's talk about you. What do you think of my plays?" Unquote. Remember, you're a human being too, and it's natural for you to be tempted to start right off talking about yourself. You want to shine. You want to impress the other fellow. But the truth of the matter is that you will rate much higher in the other person's estimation if you turn the conversation to him rather than if you turn it to yourself. He will have a much higher opinion of you and will consider you a much more intelligent person. One good rule to follow is just to ask yourself mentally this question: what do I really want in this situation? You want to shine and swell your own ego? Or do you want the other person's business, his name on a dotted line, his permission to do something, his goodwill? If all you want is to inflate your own ego, oh, go ahead and talk exclusively about yourself, but don't expect to get anything else out of the conversation. When to talk about yourself. Public speakers talk about themselves. They tell you about their experiences, their travels, their exploits, their ideas. But remember one thing. These men are invited to talk about themselves. They're asked to talk about themselves, and the audience knows what it's in for. They do not have a captive audience, but a voluntary one. The folks who attend know in advance that they're going to hear Joe Herriches speak on My Adventures in the Wilds of Africa. Unless you've hired a hall and advertised in advance, your listeners have no way of knowing that when they talk to you, they're going to be held captive and forced to listen to your exploits. The time to talk about yourself is when you are invited and asked to tell about yourself. You can count on it that if the other person is interested, he will ask you. When he does offer you an invitation to talk about yourself, don't clam up and brush him off. Tell him a little about yourself. He'll be flattered that you are on friendly enough terms with him to let him know a little bit about yourself. But don't overdo it. Answer his questions, then turn the spotlight back on him. Use the Me Too technique. Another time when it's psychologically right to bring yourself into the conversation is when you can tell the other person something about yourself that will tie into something that he said or form a bond between you. If he says, I was raised on a farm, and you say, so was I, and tell him a little about your farm experiences, it will make him feel more important. If he mentions that he eats ice cream for breakfast, and it happens that you do too, by all means tell him. If he says he was born in a little town of swamp water, and it happens that you used to spend all your summer vacations there, tell him about it. The magic of agreement. The reason that bringing yourself into the conversation in a way that forms a common bond between you is flattering to the other person is this. By doing so, you are in effect saying, I agree with you. I'm that way too. I like that too. I believe that way myself. I'm somewhat like you. Anything about you or your past experience that shows that you are like the other person will help him to like you automatically. We like people who agree with us, and we dislike people who disagree with us. Every person who agrees with us confirms our own worth and our own self-esteem. Every person who disagrees with us is a potential threat to our self-esteem. In short, when you agree with the other person, you help him like himself better. Even if there are points on which you know you must disagree with the other person, always seek out some points on which you can agree. When you've established some ground, however small, on which you can agree, you'll find it much easier to get together on those issues on which you disagree. Use happy talk. Another secret of being a good conversationalist and making people want to talk to you is to take a tip from the song from South Pacific and use happy talk as much as possible. Nobody likes a gloomy Gus. Nobody likes to sit and listen to a prophet of doom. People don't like to hear bad news. The person who falls into the habit of always talking pessimistically, of pointing out the world is going to the dogs, or of relating all his personal troubles, isn't going to win any popularity contests. If you have personal troubles that you need to talk over with someone, go to your pastor, your psychologist, or to some trusted and sympathetic friend. Don't air your troubles in public. Don't go on endlessly about your operation and describe every twinge you had from the time you went to the hospital until the time you went back to work. Telling about how much you suffered won't make you a hero. It will only make you a bore. Sit right down and write yourself a letter. If you have something on your chest and you feel as if you must tell someone about all your troubles or just how unjustly you've been treated, try this. Write yourself a letter. Put down exactly how you feel. Don't hold back anything. Go into great detail about how other people have wronged you and how unfair it is. Really make a big deal out of it. Then, when you're all through, don't mail the letter to anyone. Burn it. It served its purpose in giving you an outlet, and you'll find that you experience a great feeling of relief. More important for your human relations, it will drain off your emotions, and you'll no longer feel compelled to tell someone about them. Sometimes it's necessary to write the whole thing down twice, maybe three times. But after that, you'll find that you don't even want to think about it anymore, much less tell everyone you meet. What your best friend won't tell you. If you want to be popular through your conversation, try to overcome the temptation to kid, to tease, or to be sarcastic. Most of us kid other people because we think they will like it. Husbands tease their wives in public out of the mistaken notion that it's a cute way to show affection. We make sarcastic remarks, hoping that the other fellow will recognize our cleverness, see the humor in the sarcasm, and not take personal offense. However, teasing and kidding are both aimed at the self-esteem of the other person, and anything that threatens self-esteem is dangerous business, even when it's done in fun. Sarcasm always has a cruel element about it, and is always calculated to make the other person feel small. Research polls have shown that people do not like to be kidded, even by their close friends. However, we do not like our friends to know that we dislike kidding, for fear they'll think it's a poor sport, so even your best friend won't tell you he doesn't like it. Only in rare instances, between very close friends, is kidding ever taken in good grace, and then only if it's on some minor matter and not pursued too long. If the other person has known you long enough, likes you well enough, and you don't overdo it, you may get by with the kidding, but the odds are so great against it that it's much safer not to try. A short refresher on Chapter 8. Number 1. Both success and happiness depend in large measure on our ability to express ourselves. Therefore, start today to study ways to improve your talk and keep at it day after day. Number 2. Practice starting conversations with strangers by using the warm-up technique of asking simple questions or making obvious observations. Number 3. To be a good conversationalist, stop trying to be perfect and don't be afraid to be trite. Nuggets and gems in conversation can only come after you've dug a lot of low-grade ore. Number 4. Ask questions to bring out interesting talk from others. Number 5. Encourage the other person to talk about himself. Talk about the other person's interests. Number 6. Use the Me Too technique to identify yourself with the speaker and his interests. Number 7. Talk about yourself only when you are invited to do so by the other person. If he wants to know about you, he'll ask. Number 8. Use happy talk. Remember, nobody likes a gloomy Gus or a prophet of doom. Keep your troubles to yourself. Number 9. Eliminate kidding, teasing, and sarcasm from your conversation. Chapter 9. How to use the technique that a Supreme Court justice called white magic. When a would-be politician asked Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes for advice on how to get elected to office, Justice Holmes wrote him, "To be able to listen to others in a sympathetic and understanding manner is perhaps the most effective mechanism in the world for getting along with people and tying up their friendship for good. Too few people practice the white magic of being good listeners. In a way, each of us is running for office every day of our lives. The people we meet and talk with are constantly sizing us up, analyzing us, appraising us. In their own minds, they vote either for or against us. They give us a vote of confidence or a vote of distrust. They decide in favor of doing business with us or not, as the case may be. More times than you realize, the one deciding factor is, how well did you listen? You meet a certain person. After leaving him, you feel that everything did not go just as you would have liked. You have a sneaking suspicion that he voted against you. What did I say that turned him against me, you ask yourself, or what else could I have said that would have made him more friendly, more amenable to my ideas? Surprisingly enough, the answer may very well be nothing. You flopped, not because of anything you said or failed to say, but because you failed to listen properly. Listening makes you clever. Most of us want the other fellow to think that we're clever, intelligent, smart. But the person who goes around always making smart remarks, always knocking himself out to be clever, is not voted in by the other fellow as a clever person. Instead, he gets elected to the classification of smart-aleck, blowhard, or egotist. There is one sure way, however, to convince the other fellow that you're one of the wisest, most intelligent persons he's ever met. Listen and pay attention to what he has to say. The fact that you attach enough importance to what he's saying, that you listen attentively so as not to miss a single word, proves to him that you are a very smart person. A dope wouldn't have the sense enough to realize how valuable and important the other person's words are, and consequently wouldn't need to pay close attention. Walt Whitman and a friend were once walking down the street when Whitman stopped and engaged a stranger in conversation. For 15 or 20 minutes, Whitman monopolized the conversation, and the other fellow hardly opened his mouth. When they left, Whitman turned to his friend and said, "There was an intelligent man." "How did you know he was intelligent?" asked his friend in surprise. "Well, he hardly said a word." "Well, he listened to me, didn't he?" asked Whitman. "That proves he's an intelligent man." Stop to think for a moment of your friends and acquaintances. Who has the reputation for being intelligent and wise? How do you yourself vote on this? Do you vote for the fellow who's always shooting off his mouth? Is it the fellow who always is ready with an answer to everything, even before he knows what the question is? Is it the fellow who interrupts to give his answer before the other fellow gets through talking? Or is it the fellow who does a lot of listening? A friend of mine expresses it this way, quote, "The Lord gave us 2 ears and only 1 mouth. Evidently he intended us to do twice as much listening as talking," unquote. People will tell you what they want from you if you will listen. One of the nation's foremost automobile designers tells me that in order to be successful in the automobile manufacturing business, you have to keep your finger on the public's pulse and keep your ears open as to what the public wants. "We don't really design our cars," he says. "The public does. What we do is listen. And when the public wants something, we hasten to try to supply it." You can't make a hit in the dark. Everybody wants to make a hit with the other person. You make a hit in human relations pretty much like you make a hit on the baseball diamond, by responding properly to the ball that's thrown at you. You must continually make appropriate responses to what the other fellow throws you. Good human relations consists of two-way communication. It's give and take, action and response. If you don't know what the other fellow wants, how he really feels about a situation, what his particular peculiar needs are, you're out of touch with him. And if you can't touch him, you can't move him. Unless you know what he wants and how he feels, you are completely in the dark concerning his position. You can't make a hit in a game of human relations any more than you can make a hit on a baseball diamond while you're in pitch black darkness. How to use your own radar to locate the other person's position. What the other fellow wants and how he feels need not be a mystery. "If only I knew what his position is, I'd know more what to do," we often think. Yet it's not too difficult to find out what the other person's position is. L. N. Sears, vice president of Remington Rand and chairman of the Board of National Sales Executives, says that every salesman has his own built-in radar for locating the position of a prospect. "All you have to do is listen," says Al. "He'll tell you. Most people want us to know what their position is and try to tell us. The trouble is that we shut off our receiver and start broadcasting." Too much talk gives you away. Sometimes there are situations in dealing with others where it's important that we not show our own hand prematurely, where we need to feel out the other fellow. The strategy used in many big business deals is to first find out what the other fellow wants, what he'll settle for, before showing your hand. It's well to remember that just as we locate another person's position by listening to him talk, too much talk on our own part gives our own position away. Many successful businessmen who have a reputation for being good horse traders and being able to make the best bargain have been thought to be psychic or mind readers. Actually, their secret is nothing so mysterious. They simply encourage the other person to talk and to keep on talking while they manage to keep their own mouths shut. They know by instinct and experience a truth which Sigmund Freud, the father of psychoanalysis, first stated scientifically. If you can get the other fellow to talk enough, he simply cannot disguise his real feelings or his real motives. He may try as hard as he wishes, but invariably he will give himself away. Freud wrote a lengthy paper on unconscious slips of the tongue, showing how the unconscious always manages to make the real feelings and thoughts known. If you listen closely enough and remain alert to all the implications of what the other fellow says. By the same token, if you don't want the other person to know what's really on your mind, if you don't want to show your cards, keep your mouth shut and listen. For no matter how hard you may try to disguise it, the other person will find you out if you just keep talking long enough. Listening helps overcome self-consciousness. Another bit of white magic that listening can perform is to help you overcome self-consciousness and self-centeredness. Although psychology today has the different slant of self-interest and self-esteem, the old attitudes of self-centeredness and self-consciousness are as much in disfavor as they ever were. Both are distinct handicaps. Listening carefully to everything the other person says, paying strict attention to his tone of voice and the inflection of his words, gets your own focus of attention off yourself. And if all your attention is on the other fellow, what he is saying, what he wants, what his needs are, you can't be self-conscious, shut off from the other fellow. When you're shut off from him, you can't deal with him effectively. When your focus is all on yourself, you cannot deal with the world around you. You're like a man driving down the highway who looks only at the windshield of his car instead of through the windshield to the road ahead of him. It takes no swami to predict that he's headed for a smash-up. Many head-on collisions between two people are due to the fact that one or the other had his attention on himself rather than on the other fellow. A strong, healthy self is necessary in dealing with other people, just as a strong, healthy pair of legs and feet are required of a dancer. Any good dancing teacher, however, will tell you to get your attention off your feet while dancing. Let the dancer become foot-conscious and think too much about his feet. Let him begin to wonder whether his feet are really going to do what he wants them to do. He is apt to stumble, or at least appear awkward and mechanical. Dancing teachers do not tell you to cut off your feet or amputate your legs just because they have discovered that paying too much attention to the feet and legs can be a handicap. In fact, they encourage their students to strengthen their legs by certain exercises. When a dancer knows that his legs are strong and that he can depend upon them, he's more likely to be able to forget them while dancing than if he secretly fears his legs are too weak to see him through. In much the same way, modern psychologists do not tell us anymore to depreciate the self or overcome the self or even do away with all of our selfish instincts. What they do tell us is to get our attention off ourselves, to stop being self-centered and selfish in a petty, stupid way. Most of the advice in the past has been on how to get over self-consciousness, and it's been wrong. We've been led to believe that it's bad to care anything about the self, and that we should be ashamed to admit that we have any self-regard. Since all of us do have a yearning for self-regard, this kind of advice only makes us more concerned with self than ever, and keeps our attention glued on ourself and our own petty, selfish desires. The way to get over self-consciousness is not to tell yourself that it's a bad thing to want to think highly of yourself, but that it just doesn't work to keep all your attention on yourself. A good dancer must listen to the music. The secret of dancing, once you learn the basic steps, is not consciously to say to yourself, "Now I must be sure that my right foot goes right over here, and then I want my left foot to take one short step." If you do this, you can't listen to the music. And if you don't listen to the music, you can't keep in time or in step. A good dancer keeps his attention focused on the music the orchestra is playing and lets his feet do the right thing. Listen to the other fellow's music. In dealing with other people, we need to use a similar technique. You must listen to the music the other fellow is playing if you want to respond to it in a way that will create harmony instead of discord. Stop listening to his music and begin to think to yourself, "Now, what can I say that will top that? Or how I can get my 2 cents worth out to impress this fellow?" And you get out of step with the other fellow. If you just listen to the music and let yourself respond, you may discover something very surprising, that your own brain will work better by itself if you leave it alone, just as your feet will. You may find that you're being more spontaneous, natural, and really clever and appropriate things just seem to pop out of your mouth, may surprise you. Don't try too hard. William James said that the reason why most conversation is dull is that each party is trying too hard. When each party makes conscious effort to think of something important to say, he's afraid to say what he has to say will not merit the approval of the other fellow. But if they would just relax, said James, open their mouths and let it come out, their chances of saying something really appropriate would be increased tremendously. According to an article in the Saturday Evening Post, this is the secret of Ben Thornton, famous banker and mayor of Dallas, Texas. Thornton says the article has a knack of always saying the right thing at the right time. Yet he seldom worries about what he's going to say, even if he goes into important meetings seemingly unprepared. Thornton doesn't make detailed word-for-word speeches. He just prepares himself as fully as possible by gathering all the information and facts he can about the subject to be discussed. Dr. Pierce P. Brooks, who is a friend of Thornton, tells me, quote, "He has a world of information on tap. He listens carefully to what others have to say. He feels out the other fellow. He's not satisfied to know in a general way what the other fellow wants or what's on his mind. He wants to know exactly. After he's listened to the other fellow, he's apt to ask him to repeat some of his ideas for a second time. Then he just opens his mouth, and the right thing to fit the occasion just seems to come out automatically." Unquote. How listening can make you rich. It's been said that listening made Ben Thornton rich. People in every walk of life regard him as an understanding man. He understands people because he listens to them. You can never really understand another human being unless you are willing to listen carefully, sympathetically, and patiently. This kind of listening can make you rich, too. Rich in dollars, rich in friends, rich in satisfaction of accomplishments and happiness. One of the highest compliments you can pay to another person is simply to listen to him. By your patient listening, you say to him, "You're worth listening to." You increase his self-esteem, for every human being likes to think he has something to say that's worth saying. On the other hand, one of the most deflating things you can do to another fellow's ego is to brush him off before hearing what he has to say. Remember, people like to be paid attention to. Ever hear a wife say of her husband, "He never hears a word I say"? I could say to him the hot water tank just blew up, and all he'd say would be, "Well, is that right?" and go on reading his paper. Maybe you haven't heard this, but marital counselors hear it every day. Ever hear an employee say, "I'd like my boss fine, except he won't listen"? I go to him and tell him about a problem and ask his advice, and before I get halfway through, he interrupts and gives me a pat answer before he even knows what I'm talking about. He's not a bad guy if he'd just listen. Maybe you haven't heard those words, but grievance committees in industry hear them over and over. Ever hear a young person say, "My parents don't really understand me at all. I try to tell them how I really feel about things, what my problems are, but they just won't listen"? They either treat me like a child and brush off my problems as having no importance, or else they're so anxious to tell me how I ought to feel about things, they never know how I really feel. Juvenile court judges hear the same theme with variations every day. A lot of trouble, misery, and failure happens in our world just because someone wouldn't listen. Keep this bit of advice pasted up on the wall of your mind where you can see it at all times. You've got to know what people want, what they need, and what they are if you're going to deal with them effectively. This applies to enemies as well as to friends. It applies to children, grown-ups, big shots, and small fry. And the way to know what people want, need, and are is simply to listen to them. 7 ways to practice listening. The art of listening is so important, don't pass it over without putting it into practice. Perhaps you read something that sounds good, are convinced it's true, then resolve to put it into practice. But if you don't check yourself, you forget all about it in a day or two. One way to overcome this is to list some definite things to do and start doing them. So nail down the knowledge you gained in this chapter, and don't let it get away. Starting right now, practice the following. 1, look at the person who's talking. Anybody worth listening to is worth looking at. It'll also help your concentration on what he's saying. 2, appear deeply interested in what he's saying. If you agree, nod your head. If he tells a story, smile. Respond to his cue. Work with him. 3. Lean toward the person who's talking. Ever notice you have a tendency to lean toward an interesting talker and lean away from a dull one? 4. Ask questions. This lets the person who's talking know that you're listening. 5. Don't interrupt. Instead, ask him to tell more. Most people are highly complimented if you don't interrupt them until they're through. But they're doubly complimented if you draw them out. Would you mind going into that last point a little more fully? Or I'd like to know a little more about what you were saying concerning such and such. 6. Stick to the speaker's subject. Don't change subjects on a person until he is finished, no matter how anxious you are to get started on a new one. 7. Use the speaker's words to get your own point across. When the other fellow has finished talking, repeat back to him some of the things that he said. This not only proves you've been listening, but a good way to introduce your own ideas without opposition. Preface some of your own remarks with, as you pointed out, or it's just like you said.